This season is made possible with the generous support of the Kimmel Schatzky Traumatic Brain Injury Innovation Fund. Hello and welcome to another episode of Injury Is Not Equal. I'm your host, Shaylin, from the Center for Injury Prevention at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. We're on a mission to uncover the truths and realities about injury risk and impact. We're laying everything on the table as we engage in critical conversation in hopes to change the narrative and raise awareness about health inequity in injury. We hope you'll join us. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. This episode contains discussions about intimate partner violence and traumatic events, which may be sensitive for some listeners. Listener's discretion is advised.
If we educate the folks who are supporting survivors, if we educate police, you know, it right from the moment where a police officer answers a call, the pathways of what can happen for those survivors are very different. So if a police officer sees a woman on the doorstep who's slurring her words, who's unsteady on her feet, whose recall capacity is a little bit funny, she's not able to talk about things in a linear pattern, she's sort of bouncing all over the place from a communication perspective, or her emotions are completely out of control. All of those things, if there's sort of, you know, a couple of beer bottles in the background or something, police officers will often think that there's a drug or alcohol situation happening. When in fact, the first thing I think is, did she just have her head bounced off a wall?
It is estimated that for every NHL player who suffers a brain injury, approximately 7,000 Canadian women experience the same as a result of intimate partner violence. This equates to about 250,000 new cases of IPV-related brain injury each year in Canada. Intimate partner violence is a major public health crisis and includes physical, emotional, sexual, verbal, and other forms of abuse. Nearly one in three women worldwide will experience IPV in their lifetime, placing them at high risk of acquiring a traumatic brain injury. In this episode, I am joined by guest speaker Lynn Hogg, who is a PhD candidate and contract faculty member with the Faculty of Social Work at Wilfrid Laurier University. Lynn is also a research trainee at the Acquired Brain Injury Research Lab at the University of Toronto, where she recently worked on the development of an educational toolkit called The Abused and Brain Injured. We asked Lynn her reasoning behind developing this toolkit and how it supports survivors of intimate partner violence.
We built the Abused and Brain Injured Toolkit. You can get it. You can get access to it at www.abitoolkit.com or .ca. And it's freely available to anyone with online access. We built it originally to support frontline workers in an IPV context. So what we discovered in our very first project in, I think, about 2015 or 2016, was that frontline workers really had no knowledge or awareness of the intersection itself. They weren't aware that brain injury could happen as a result of exposure to intimate partner violence, and that it was actually quite common. So that those two things together sort of made us realize that the first step really was as big and wide an education opportunity as we could find. And since I can't go everywhere and be everywhere in all places at once, we decided to build an online resource and be able to do that. We were very lucky to get funding from Justice Canada actually to do that. And it was a two-year project that included a lot of stakeholders, including survivors and frontline workers themselves, executive directors, all of that from organizations. All of those were part of the group that came together to design this. So it really was community-driven and survivor-driven. And it provides basic information on intimate partner violence-related brain injury. In the beginning, we envisioned that it would be only frontline workers in the IPV context that would have access to it. So we didn't include any IPV information. We figured that would be preaching to a choir, and why would we do that? But it became apparent that that wasn't the case, and that there were a lot of folks, particularly in frontline and medical and in first responders, who wanted that IPV piece as well. So we've been working the last 6-8 months or so on a 2.0 version of the toolkit, which will be released, I'm hoping, early this year, so early 2023. And it includes a new module on IPV basics as well, so that folks who don't have that information already can get that from it as well. And really, what we tried to do was create a repository for any resources we could find, any links out into the community for support services. So for instance, we have in every province of the country, we have at least one brain injury support service that a survivor could access. Now in somewhere like Toronto, we have a number, we have quite a few more than just one, but in somewhere like, you know, in very rural areas and remote areas of Northern Ontario or in the territories themselves, a lot of the East Coast provinces have much fewer opportunities. So we've at least tried to provide one for everybody. There are downloadable resources. So there are things like infographics, there are little videos that are going to be going up in the new 2.0 that folks can use to share with their clients or for their own information, however that works. And I think one of the things that we found in terms of how does it support survivors, you know, we thought, oh, well, it will trickle down. So right from that very first moment, it's incredibly important that folks are just aware of the possibilities in front of them and are seeking information so that they can open up the pathways to care that are relevant and that are necessary. So I think that was one of the ways that we saw this having a direct impact for survivors. The second one is that one of the things I tell folks is, you know, use the toolkit however you want, use it as an education tool for yourself, but also share it. Sit down with a survivor and say, does any of this look familiar to you? Does this make you think of your own experiences? And we did include some firsthand voices and experiences in the toolkit. So there is that sort of opportunity for shared experience and for validation. I think one of the things that's so difficult for survivors is they feel like it's all them, and they're getting that messaging all the time. You're not smart. You're stupid. You're bad. You can't do anything right. Right. All of those negative messages that are being handed to them by a controlling partner, they feed into brain injury very quickly. And for someone who's then isolated as well, she may have no other way of understanding what's happening in her life and being able to see that it's not her. It's not her fault. There's another opportunity and another option here. So I think in that sense, it also offers a direct support component for survivors themselves.
Wow, what an incredible toolkit. Clearly, this toolkit has the power to lead survivors down the correct path, allowing them to access the right resources and appropriate treatment. By educating and raising awareness among first responders and other medical professionals, there's opportunity to identify a survivor much earlier and connect them with the necessary supports. Lynn told us about the lack of education surrounding TBI within the IPV sector and how this field has evolved in recent years.
It was really difficult in 2016 when we did the first project. And one of the things that we did was we held the first summit in the country that brought together survivors, service providers, policymakers, advocacy, research. They were all in the room together. And we gave them sort of a day-long process and gave them some basic introduction stuff in the morning. And then we broke into small groups and talked about what is happening? What do you know about this? You know, how much of what we just told you this morning is a shocking surprise? How much do you want to say, oh yeah, we knew about that? And what do we need to do next? And the overwhelming message that came out of it, one was nobody had really any awareness that this was happening at all. I can actually see her face, a woman who had been offering services directly in the IPV sector for over 25 years. And she looked at me and she said, I can't believe I didn't know this. All of the women that I have supported, how many of them were in this position and I didn't know? How could I have been so bad at my job? And it's, you know, it's nobody's fault. She wasn't bad at her job. She was doing it to the best of her capacity. But the piece that came out of that for us, the sort of the big piece, was the need for education across so many sectors. Nobody knew about this at all 8 to 10 years ago. When I started in this field, I was standing on a street corner, you know, telling anybody who'd listen, and there weren't that many stopping to listen. It took a lot of effort to get those 30 or 40 folks that we had in the room in 2016. Now I can speak to crowds of groups of hundreds at a time easily, and there is an awareness that's already out there. And so I think that's one of the things that's really shifted. But we had to prioritize which group did we want to educate first. And it was really difficult. Those first responders were so high on my priority list with that and with all of us that it was really difficult to say, we're going to set that group aside and we're going to focus on frontline and make this toolkit for frontline. I was actually really pleased when I discovered that it would go beyond the frontline boundaries and that we needed the IPV module. Mm-hmm. I thought that's great. At least we've managed to include those other groups, because it's so important that right from the very beginning that that understanding is there and that recognition piece is there. We don't need them to diagnose on the doorstep. We just need them to know that that's a possibility and to consider the best path forward because of that.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And that story, it gave me goosebumps listening to it, because it does make you think, and it reminds you that we're always learning. You know, there is always more to learn. And even if you've been in a field for X amount of years, it doesn't mean that you know everything and you're capturing everything. And absolutely, it really does raise awareness that, you know, we need more education and more awareness out there. So I know that a lot of your toolkit and a lot of your research does focus primarily on women within this field. And research does indicate approximately 1 in 3 women will experience IPV in their lifetime. And given this alarming data, I understand that your research and toolkit does focus primarily on this population. And I wonder if you can touch on some of the other intersecting identity and system factors that impact risk and outcome of IPV-related TBI.
Absolutely. And I think this is a super question, and I'm so glad you asked it. And I think the first piece to recognize is that this doesn't just happen to women. This happens to folks across the gender spectrum. The reason that my research focuses on women, the reason that we use that terminology a lot, is that statistically, because of a variety of factors, one being that 1 in 3 women will experience intimate partner violence over their lifetime. And that's actually a global statistic. Here in Canada, we are very similar. So it's not that, you know, this is happening at home just as much as it's happening anywhere else. And it also, the sort of just the physical nature of a violent encounter, it's more likely statistically you're going to have more women brain injured survivors than other groups. That's all. So I just look at, because this is such a brand new field, I look at what is the largest group that is likely to be needing services. And then how do we from there narrow and specify and tailor services to those, to everybody else. So that's the first piece of the puzzle to recognize. And the next piece is that it happens across all different socioeconomic backgrounds, variable education levels. So it's not just happening to one kind of person. It happens to every kind of person. And it can happen overnight. It's not those people who make bad choices or get themselves into problems and then this is the result and then they can't even get out, kind of, right? Like, there's all of that stigma and conversation around it. And it's not like that. It can happen to anyone, anytime. I think one of the largest demographics actually is young women in post-secondary education age. So kind of like 18 to 25, I think that's actually one of the largest demographics. Lots of women in universities who are reporting partner violence, you know, what we used to call date rape, that kind of experience. So I think that's certainly relevant to consider. The reality is, though, that some folks are more vulnerable inherently than others because of other intersecting identities. For instance, women with disabilities are more likely to be in violent relationships than women without disabilities, which is particularly concerning if you think that that brain injury is a disability. So you can be falling into the category of not having a disability, experience intimate partner violence, be brain injured as a result of that. Now you're part of the category of women with disabilities. Now you're more likely to be in a relationship where you're going to experience violence. So it's this huge potential feedback loop that is, I find, actually really quite terrifying. But also then you've got other folks who have barriers to accessing support. So perhaps for cultural reasons, there are all kinds of cultural conversations around what is partner violence, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, what is expected, what is not expected. Those kinds of conversations shape how somebody might react and how they might seek services, how might they or might not identify as someone who has experienced partner violence. If that's not part of what they see as themselves, then that's a barrier to services beyond that because they're not going to ask for them. There are also identities where there are fewer resources available. So certainly many women who are in very remote areas, those tend to be sort of reserve areas or very northern communities. We have a lot of challenge with delivering effective and viable services in northern communities, in Nunavut, for instance. We know of a lot of need in those communities, but a lot of difficulty in providing service. And we've made a lot of mistakes in terms of assuming that we can have a one-size-fits-all service model. So here, this is our solution to the problem. Just go take that and implement that into whatever community you might come from. And it doesn't work. But we seem to be really resistant to the notion of it doesn't work. And let's start figuring out how to do that. So one of the things, for instance, we've had some resources that we developed, some educational resources that we developed for a settler community. And we had a fantastic organization that supports Inuit women and Inuit communities called Paktutit, which is based in Ottawa. And they took our resources and indigenized them in a way that would be meaningful and accessible for the communities in Nunavut. And then they distributed them through pathways that made sense. So I built a toolkit. Well, that works if you have infrastructure and you have internet and you can access it. And you would do so. But for communities that have much more, much richer oral traditions, who don't use internet in the same way, who might focus on Facebook rather than websites, we've heard that from these communities, all those pieces act then as barriers to what we are calling service uptake.
So services and resources are great if they're delivered in a way that's appropriate for the populations accessing them. Approximately 6 in 10 Indigenous women have experienced some form of IPV in their lifetime. More specifically, Indigenous women are 2 times more likely than non-Indigenous women to experience physical abuse from an intimate partner. Indigenous women continue to face many intersecting factors, such as intergenerational trauma and systemic racism, that increases their risk of experiencing various forms of violence.
So I think there's a huge need around recognizing the limitations of what we have available and working to address some of those. It doesn't mean that you have to reinvent the wheel. Brain injury is brain injury. That's the beauty of it, actually. All the work that we've put into sport concussion work, we don't need to throw it out. We just need to take it and trauma sensitize it and hand it out in such a way that it can now be taken up by various groups. So we're getting there in that sense. But yeah, I think there are a lot of problems in terms of how we offer services like that. Those of us who have traditionally been in the roles of doing the research, creating the knowledge, developing the resources, and delivering them, we need to step back. I mean, I view that as going forward and saying, okay, I have this really weird specialized knowledge on this very strange intersection that's actually happening an awful lot and is really, really important, but I don't know how to do anything in your community. So how about we sit down together, I give you the nuts and bolts, and you tell us what you need us to do with it and how you need us to present it for you. I sort of see myself as a walking book, a walking, talking book, as opposed to anybody who has any kind of solution. Really, for me, the solutions need to come from the community themselves. They need to be rooted in whatever the cultural and racial implications for that community are, whatever those intersecting identities are, whether they be gender-based or culturally based or racially based, whatever, they need to be rooted in those worldviews. And then from there, they need to grow and develop under the direction of the folks who live it. And really, I'm just the resource for that to happen.
What a great perspective. We wanted to know more about these intersecting factors and how they influence a survivor's ability to access care and treatment. As Lynn told us, this is not a simple issue and involves many complexities.
That's one of the most difficult things to solve, really. And it's because it's very complex. Brain injury is super complex, and IPV is really, really complex. And then you layer them together and you get a whole new interconnectedness about it that is really difficult to get to. Part of it is that hidden piece that you were talking about. Part of it is that shame and blame piece that I brought up earlier. Part of it is the lack of recognition, the lack of knowledge around it. And all of those things make it really difficult. What we find then is that we have a community of survivors that is incredibly diverse. Then you layer into that, that there is no one type of survivor. So when you think about what I said about every different kind of background, every socioeconomic background, every racialized group, women who are employed, women who are not employed, women who have children, women who don't have children, men, transgendered folks, all those different identity pieces create a different need. And so the offerings of service that one has need to be both broad enough to be useful across those spectrums, but they also need to be specific enough to account for the individualities of experience and be accessible. So my toolkit is great if you have good internet access and it's the kind of thing you might have gone to anyways. And what we discovered very early on, we actually published a paper out of that whole process that looked at Indigenous groups in Canada and how effective was the toolkit going to be really for them. And the answer sadly was not much, which was actually really quite difficult. It didn't take long in terms of asking questions around it for us to discover that it wasn't going to be very effective. And why was that? And what on earth could I do about that? Were the sort of the two big questions that came out of that. So we realized that we would have to go back to the drawing board in many respects. And furthermore, that it really wasn't us that should be doing that. That should be done by the communities that wanted to be able to do it themselves. We should just be offering the support where we could. So I think that whole, it has to be big and broad, but it also has to be narrow and specific, makes it incredibly difficult. And then when you think about how baby steps we really are, honestly, when I think about how this field looked 10 years ago, there were 3 researchers, maybe 4 in North America. You know, it was very easy for me to do a scoping review of the literature in 2019 because there were only 40 papers. How far we've come is remarkable in a short period of time. But the reality is, you put us up against breast cancer. And the interesting thing about IPV-related brain injury, if you go to the statistics and you go to the literature and the research, your prevalence rates are the same. So you have 1 in 8 Canadian women from breast cancer, and you have 1 in 8 Canadian women with the possibility of a brain injury as a result of intimate partner violence exposure. And we don't have a tiny little piece of what breast cancer research, practice, supports, medical intervention, psychological intervention, lack of shame and stigma. None of those are a problem for breast cancer. We don't have any of that in IPV brain injury. So we've doubled our researcher count, and we've done an awful lot of educating and an awful lot of soapbox standing and talking about that. But we're still in our infancy, really tiny baby steps in this field. And we're working hard to develop those basic levels of service and knowledge while still keeping a sort of an eye on the ball in terms of how do we make these specific enough to be useful to groups that are experiencing those further areas of marginalization and vulnerability because of those intersectional identities. So we're basically trying to do everything at once, and we needed it about 10 years ago. And everybody needs to know about it all at once. And it, you know, there are 4 of us doing it. It's a challenge, and I feel very lucky to work in a field with incredibly educated and diverse and very passionate colleagues who really all of us just we just pick up the phone and say, what do you need? You know, where do we need to go next? How do we get people together? And you know, it's fantastic. It's happening. There are three or four doctoral level students out west working with a colleague, Paul Van Donkeler and Karen Mason in the SOAR project. They've been doing super work. We celebrate where we've come, but we do still need to see that it's tiny, tiny steps in a world of a lot to be done.
I was really blown to hear about the prevalence of IPV TBI survivors being the same as women with breast cancer.
You just have to do the math. And I come to that number actually really conservatively. So the research shows that up to 75% of survivors of intimate partner violence will have possible brain injury as a result of that exposure. And the numbers are really broad spread. So we have anything from as low as about 19 or 20% up to the 75%. There are some studies that show 100% of survivors, but those are very specific samples and very targeted samples. So generally speaking, those of us in the field, we recognize them. We tend to agree with them in many ways. But from a scientific perspective, we set those aside and we've remained with the 75% mark. And what I do, because there's this huge range, and the reason for that has got a lot to do with sampling challenges and difficulties with this particular population, rather than an unpredictable spread like this. So I take a nice neat 50%. If we say that 50% of all women exposed to intimate partner violence have a probability or a possibility of a traumatic brain injury as a result of that exposure, and you say, we'll take the conservative estimate of 1 in 4 women as opposed to 1 in 3, it usually falls, it's a little bit variable depending on what part of the world you are. Some parts of the world, you're looking at closer to 1 in 4. Some parts of the world, you're looking at a little bit more like 1 in 3. It depends on who you're looking at. But if you take that nice conservative piece of 1 in 4, and you take your 50% of those women have probable brain injuries as a result of that violence, and all of that has been published in the research. If you just do the math, that's 1 in 8 survivors. And that's the same statistic as breast cancer. So it's a shocker. I agree with you. And it's one that I usually bring forward because it does have that impact and it makes it real. Who doesn't know someone who's had breast cancer? Guess what? You probably know someone who's had an exposure to intimate partner violence who may very well have some sort of cognitive impact from that violence.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for this very informative discussion on the intersection between IPV and TBI. Stay tuned for part 2, where the conversation continues as we unpack some of the long-term disparities and solutions needed to address this complex intersection.
There needs to be an understanding of the unique characteristics of this particular mechanism of injury. And there has to be a sensitivity to that.
If you would like to know more about the Acquired Brain Injury Research Lab, or the Abused and Brain Injured Toolkit, the websites will be linked in the show notes of this episode. Be sure to connect with us on Twitter and Instagram at Let's Talk Injury. We encourage you to give our podcast a follow so you can be updated when new episodes are released. If you found this episode valuable, please rate and leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.